Hi, this is Ben Smith from the Politico with my colleague Jonathan Martin. We're both slightly stressed out to be taking minutes away from our blog, and it's in the middle of the day. But it's been a fairly intense 24 hours of politics, beginning with Eliot Spitzer's shocking resignation, also including just a lot of videos that's been floating around in the last 12, 24 hours. Keith Olbermann's intense 10-minute rant against Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama's pastor Jeremiah Wright in a Christmas sermon that Fox News got a hold of, which he had some fairly sharp things to say about race. I'd be interested in what Jonathan covers the Republicans. What are the Republicans saying about that?
Well, not just the Fox News report, Ben, but also this morning, Brian Rawls on ABC News on Good Morning America had more footage of Pastor Wright at the church, and the conservative blogs are going crazy over this today, and a lot of Republican operatives are just really almost giddy with excitement to have this, like you said, Ben, on video, and that's sort of the key here, is to have this in the can, and it's really for, you know, conservatives, fodder for a potential general election against Obama. You just, you know, toss a disclaimer at the end of some of these videos, splice them together, some of his more extreme comments, right, and it could be very damaging to Obama.
So somebody going to put this on television if he's the nominee? Are we going to see this in you know, on Ohio TV, on the airwaves in Ohio?
Right. I'm not sure if McCain ever would, but as you know, Ben, there are plenty of interested parties out there on the right who could form some kind of a committee or a PAC or a 527 or God knows what and put this thing on the air.
So what's Obama supposed to do? I mean, the guy doesn't. He has some kind of honorary title with the campaign. He's a member of a leadership committee. I asked them this morning whether they were going to, in the grand tradition of these leadership committees, toss him off, because that seems to be the only thing these committees actually are for, and they basically wouldn't say.
No, I think he's in a very, very tough spot. Obviously, he doesn't want to repudiate a man that he has a personal relationship with, who, you know, married him and his wife, but at the same time, politically, he's smart enough to recognize that this could be damaging down the road. But, Ben, while we're talking about these honorary chairmen, perhaps we should take a huge deviation here because it is blogging heads and we're just sort of riffing, and talk about these honorary chairs and the sort of process of making off-message comments and then being forced to resign from campaign posts that are really fictional to start with.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's sort of hard to describe when you're writing about it. You know, they like Geraldine Ferraro's finance committee post was, I think it was basically just the kind of post you give somebody to make them feel good, feel involved in the campaign. But
right.
You know, and so I mean, so her, the loss of Geraldine Ferraro to the Clinton campaign was not a substantive change in the campaign. Samantha Power, by contrast, had a similarly kind of, you know, thin sounding connection. I think she was like a member of a foreign policy advisory group, but was in fact, you know, somebody Obama talked to, somebody who's kind of contributing real ideas. But it seems, you know, they've got hundreds of these groups there. Obama was forced to dump somebody from his LGBT group
who said
some sort of harsh stuff about Clinton.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of, in a way, useful because it gives these campaigns like a way to indicate their displeasure with supporters.
Right. Somebody somewhere every day is saying something off message, and one of the campaigns is feverishly trying to find those comments via Nexus or Google or what have you, and then combing it back through some kind of a master list of advisory committees and finding their news of the day.
And does John McCain just like this is going to happen like every day for the next 9 months that somebody in the Republican Party is going to say something nasty about Barack Obama? What does McCain do? Does he, like, every day fire that person, every day at the press conference, take questions about it?
You know,
do we get bored?
I talked to them about just that, and the McCain folks said, look, we're not going to spend every single day repudiating something stupid that some conservative or some Republican said somewhere. They recognize the danger here, but they're just, I think, hoping to avoid letting these things distract them. But it's going to be tough because, you know, we in the press are going to ask them every time a congressman like Steve King from Iowa last week, you know, goes there, if you will, and talks about Hussein and Obama. And it's going to be a problem. And I think, Ben, that's why you saw Rick Davis, the McCain campaign manager, issue that memo to some of their surrogates this week, saying, this is what we want you to be saying. Here are the campaign talking points that are all pro-McCain, and you know, let us worry about our opponents. Now, that's never going to happen. Rush Limbaugh picked that up and basically said, look, McCain folks, I'm going to say what I'm going to say, and you guys can't control that. So I think to a certain degree,
well, isn't
they don't
McCain
want
just washing his hands of it there? I mean, that's kind of incredibly effective. If he sincerely says, please, guys, don't do it, and then they do, like, isn't that the best case scenario for him?
I think it could be just that. In fact, we were talking about that earlier here in the office, Ben, that to a certain degree that, you know, there's the potential for inoculation. McCain can wash his hands of it, like you said, and say, well, look, I have told these folks not to say these things. I'm not saying them. My campaign's not saying them. I can't control outside forces. But it's kind of the best of both worlds, because then McCain looks above the fray, and he lets other folks sort of do his dirty work and getting this stuff in circulation.
I wonder if we get bored of it. I wonder if the media gets bored of it. You know, it's just because it's every day. You get tired of writing the same story. Grievance is a touchy thing. Obama, as he said yesterday, never calls anybody a racist. He's very careful, usually, and his campaign is to not to kind of go out and kind of play victim, just because people really, you know, there's a sense that voters don't like that. That his race politics are about kind of not being aggrieved. They're about forgiving Joe Biden. And one of my favorite qualifications for an Obama vice presidential nominee is that he be a racist. That was suggested to me, so that Obama can kind of enact this forgiveness on a grand scale.
You know, I'm not sure that we'll ever have fatigue of this stuff. I mean, I do think that if it's the same sort of message, we'll stop eventually, you know, being consumed by it. But, you know, nothing obviously moves the needle like race in America. So I think that, and religion obviously tossed in there too. So, I mean, I think this stuff's going to be, you know, very much part of the campaign if he's the nominee.
Yeah, and it's something Obama spent, you know, his whole life thinking about. His first book is subtitled A Story of Race and Inheritance, something he thinks a lot about. Something he, like, and what I was referring to before, that moment, there was a moment of debate with Joe Biden where Biden gets on stage and Biden is pressed on kind of having said off-color stuff, and Obama, unprompted, comes to his rescue and kind of forgives him.
I remember that.
And then, and kind of by extension, forgives everyone else who's ever, you know, made a kind of a racist slip.
He offered absolution, as they say in the Catholic Church.
Exactly.
Right. But so, now, look, I mean, I think that for exactly the reason that you said, that Obama has thought about these issues for a very long time, he's got to be trying to right now game out exactly how to approach the issue of his pastor and sort of how to address that, knowing darn for well, because he's also a very smart politician, knowing darn for well that it's going to come back this fall if he's the nominee.
They've done a good job. I mean, it's an unusual thing because the standard approach of campaigns is to try to get everything out early. And this is one of these things, like several others, where the Obama campaign has taken the reverse approach and just been like kept a lid on it to this point.
Yeah.
But it's now it's starting to blow up.
No, exactly. You know, we heard some of this, Ben, when Obama first announced his campaign a year ago in Springfield, Illinois, when Wright was, I guess, disinvited from giving the invocation. And there have been a few issues since then, but this is really the first time that Wright has become a sort of dominant storyline. Isn't that accurate?
Yeah, and it's really just coincidental. I mean, the Clinton campaign hasn't been like, you know, it wasn't handing out videos 6 months ago.
Right.
Fox seems to have bought these videos from the church. So
right.
It was sort of a matter of Obama becoming the front runner and people kind of getting around to going through his life piece by piece.
Yeah. No, because the Clinton folks didn't really want to go there, right?
I mean, they certainly didn't want to be caught going there, and I haven't caught them doing it.
Right.
So,
right.
Conspiracy theories abound.
We could talk about this all day, but you are right now in what is the center of the universe, which it typically is, but it really is this week, and you are a New York political guru. So just tell us a little bit about what has sort of gone down with the Spitzer case and how you see this thing going forward here in the days ahead with now Governor Patterson.
Well, it was so shocking. I was sitting in the basement of City Hall with Liz Benjamin from the Daily News and Ozzie Pabero from the Observer, and Liz just gets up and starts kind of swearing. And we took us a few couple minutes to get out of her what was going on, and then they raced up to this Midtown press conference. But and that was just when the New York Times story had gone online. Saying that Spitzer, and at first the word was linked to a prostitution ring, so we were trying to figure, you know,
right.
There was some suggestion that meant that he was the pimp, which obviously was a very extraordinary
In and of itself, yeah.
And it was like just a total shocker, you know, like with McGreevy, for instance. It had been rumored for years that he was gay. It was sort of a joke in the State House. Republican legislators would send out press releases referring to the guy who was alleged to have been his boyfriend as his companion, like for weeks in advance. And they had been desperately trying to keep this one down, and finally it blew up. This was the opposite. You know, nobody... I mean, I talked to somebody who had, this morning, who had traveled with Spitzer from quite frequently on his Senate and his governor's campaign, just never had a hint of it. It was just not, it wasn't in the air. It was, and that's not usually true with politicians. Like, you usually feel like you kind of get to know these people. So it was just a real secret. And, you know, he didn't, it's a funny thing. Like, sexual indiscretions, I don't think, particularly in New York, which isn't the most socially kind of righteous state. I mean, if David Vitter can survive it in Louisiana, you'd think a New Yorker could. But it was who Spitzer was. You know, he said he actually totally nailed it in his resignation speech. He said, you know, I've always demanded that powerful people take responsibility for their actions, and I'm going to do that too. And I mean, basically, he has never cut anybody any slack. He's never, when he was a prosecutor, he forgave nobody anything. He nailed people on the smallest thing he possibly could. He ruined people's lives, and so nobody was going to cut him any slack.
Yeah. No, it was really an extraordinary story. And Ben, you've written about David Paterson, and for a lot of us political junkies, even the hardiest among us, very, very little is known about David Paterson. I guess what I'm curious about at this point, because we're always thinking about the next election, is it realistic that he would run for re-election in 2010?
You know, I mean, it's the assumption, right? He's going to be the incumbent Democratic governor. But, I mean, there are two reasons to think. I mean, there, you know, and yet already both Republicans and other Democrats are thinking, you know, that they might have a shot. And there are two reasons for that. One is that he's really just walking into a disastrous situation. Spitzer's committed to just a whole lot of school funding in a way that, and as meanwhile, Wall Street, the state's main source of income, is having a very bad year. And it just seems like they're on track for a quite large tax increase, you know, next year or the year after. And that's kind of a formula for trouble for an elected official. It's the sort of stuff you want to get out at the beginning of your term, which he is not going to have the possibility to do. And then the other thing is that he's never actually faced a competitive election in his life. He was handed his Senate seat by the kind of Harlem machine in 1986, I think, and then occupied it really obscurely for 20 years. And Spitzer picked him. He needed an African American running mate because he had problems with black Democrats. He'd done some cases against just kind of people close to the Harlem establishment. And he was turned down by at least one other person, turned to Paterson, who he really likes personally, but whom Paterson told me right after he was picked. He said he didn't vet me, you know. He didn't vet him at all. And in fact, Paterson had said, let me vet myself for you, because Paterson is an incredibly forthcoming guy. He had then sent Spitzer all the documentation on two lawsuits against his office, and then, you know, proceeded to tell me about them at great length. And he's a charmingly direct guy.
He's a rarity for a politician, and we should actually use this opportunity now to put in a plug for Ben's story on David Paterson, both here at Politico, and also if you hop on this website called google.com and type in Ben Smith and Observer and Paterson. Ben has a great profile of the now governor back from 06?
Yeah, it was from 06. And, you know, it's just, he had never been, he just, it was just happened that he'd never really been examined. When I kind of went through his official biographies, it said he was born in Harlem, which he wasn't. It said he was he had been an assistant district attorney, which was kind of in doubt because he hadn't passed the bar. So, you know, I mean, it's just, he's just not somebody who's been examined. He's not somebody who's, and his both his kind of greatest flaw, and maybe, as he puts it, is that he wants to please everybody. And he's been a conciliator for Spitzer, who's been a nightmare to deal with for the legislature. You know, some people up there are kind of hoping they'll eat him alive. I mean, the legislators are. But, you know, we'll see. It depends a lot on who he surrounds himself with.
Would Bloomberg and or Rudy, you think, run for governor, Ben?
I mean, it would be a path to kind of rehabilitation for Rudy. They're the only Republicans who come to mind who would have that kind of money at hand.
Right.
And Bloomberg, I don't think Bloomberg wants to live in Albany. It's kind of a step down from mayor of New York, not in terms of power, but in terms of, of kind of the stage.
Right. Right. Well, with no offense to our viewers in Albany, there's obviously a huge difference between Albany and York City. So
there's a bit of a difference. I mean, Mike would, you know, pilot his helicopter back and forth. I don't think he'd spend a lot of nights in Albany.
True.
But he would also, I suspect, have trouble disguising his scorn for Albany, which isn't a good thing.
Right, right. It's almost like Koch-esque in that way. Ben, has anybody heard from Tom Golisano in the past week?
Say that again?
Has anybody heard from Tom Golisano in the past week?
Wow, you should ask your friend Roger Stone. I don't know. this was this New York billionaire from Buffalo who ran for governor unsuccessfully, ran quite kind of tactical, bizarre campaigns, and very expensive, made some political consultants very wealthy. Including the notorious Roger Stone.
But, no, you just mentioned folks who would have the kind of money to pay for a campaign, talking about Bloomberg or potentially Rudy, and it just struck me that there's the ever-present Golisano factor in New York politics. Like, Mark Green and Tom Golisano are sort of like the evergreens of New York politics.
Yeah, one other, just to switch topics abruptly, I wanted to ask you about your story.
Very abruptly.
Up on Politico.
Very abruptly.
Your story up on Politico today about McCain saying that he can play and play outside the traditional red states. But like, tell me about this. I'm a bit of a skeptic. Where can he play? Where does support for the Iraq War and for the Bush economic policies play well?
Well, see, I think you're looking at it in a way that the McCain folks would encourage you not to.
And
that is by talking about issues. For McCain, it's never been about issues, Ben. His appeal is rooted based upon his character and the fact that Americans, even those who disagree with him, just happen to like the guy. And you ask them why, as I have at campaign events all over the country, and they never mention issues. They just mention the fact that he's a straight shooter, he's a man of integrity, and he means what he says. And so I think for McCain, it's never been about issues, and it's not going to be this time. Instead, they think that sort of maverick appeal would play well in states that have a tradition of rewarding independent-leaning politicians. Places like New Hampshire, which is the first one certainly on the list. Obviously, he has a lot of goodwill there based upon his two primaries. Next door, Maine, which has elected an independent governor. Even though both those states are very much anti-war, very much sort of crunchy, if you will. But the fact is that McCain's brand could play well there. Similarly,
who does he want to run against?
Places like Minnesota and Wisconsin, Ben, maybe even Washington and Oregon, even though the trends there are terrible for Republicans. These are places where the only Republican in America who could potentially be competitive is John McCain. So I think those are sort of the blue places that would come to mind. And then also, they think that if Obama is the nominee, they're going to have real opportunities in the industrial Midwest, places like Pennsylvania and Michigan that have gone for Democrats, but that now can be back in play.
And who's the ideal? Who do they want to run against?
It's a great question. I think that there's been a sort of shifting of the tide in some ways. Most Republicans have long thought that Hillary was the best, especially against McCain, because she could motivate the GOP base in a way that McCain couldn't. They would come out against her, and not so much for McCain, but just against her, because she obviously is so polarizing and is the public enemy number one for a lot of Republicans. But I think that as this primary on the Dem side has unfolded, they've seen some of Obama's vulnerabilities, and they are now, I think, looking more favorable upon Obama being the nominee for a couple of reasons. First of all, that national security contrast, the experience contrast. Obviously, the two of them side by side, just the look favors Obama because of their ages. But when you're talking about experience and matters like national security, if it's going to be fought on that terrain, they want Obama. And then secondly, just because of some of the demographic issues that have come to the fore here, especially among downscale Democrat voters, some Hispanics, they think that because McCain was more of a comprehensive guy on immigration, Ben, that he could actually keep some of those Hispanics in the fold, and especially if Obama is the nominee, even more so.
It's fascinating because it's these two just really different coalitions in a way. I mean, if he's running against Hillary, he's just shooting for the middle, shooting for the independents. If he's running against Obama, he's going for these demographic groups. I mean, do you see him pulled in two directions? Does he have to do different stuff, I wonder?
A little bit. And let me just mention the sort of game plan if Hillary's the nominee. I mean, they think that if that's the case, then some of those upscale Democrats, some of those upscale independents who have really moved away from the party in recent years, can't stand President Bush, but also aren't terribly fond of Hillary or the Clintons either, they think that they could get those folks if Obama was knocked out.
What about, what about African Americans? What's John McCain's? I mean, he used. I know that, you know. I know he voted in 1980 something against the Martin Luther King holiday.
Martin Luther King.
But more recently, he's had a pretty good record on that stuff, right? I mean, he has some case to make.
Yeah, but I mean, look. If Obama is the nominee, it's
if Obama's the nominee, but if Hillary's the nominee.
If Hillary's the nominee, I think that the expectation is that black voters would be very, very turned off. Perhaps not come out for McCain, but some might stay home.
Right.
But, you know, their hope is that if she's the nominee, there would be enough of those upscale, independent, moderate Republican types in places like Maine, New Hampshire, but also the Philadelphia suburbs, suburban Columbus, Ohio, you know, perhaps a suburban Detroit, the sort of middle class, upper middle class places, Ben, that would be inclined to support Obama, but if he got knocked out, could come back to McCain.
So do the McCain people, do they like a long, bruising Democratic primary, even though it seems like it kind of shuts McCain out of the media?
Yeah. I mean, well, they're worried about being shut out, and they're worried about the news cycle, which is why they're taking some of these trips. You know, he's going to Europe and the Middle East, including Iraq, and they're going to try and get a lot of national and international news doing that. And he'll do some other tours here in the weeks ahead.
Basically take some press hostage and drag it around the world to make sure he gets covered.
But here's the thing, though, is that, Ben, as you know, I mean, they really lack much of a staff. They don't have a lot of money. They have not, you know, fleshed out a lot of policy ideas. Having this time period is much more upside than it is downside.
Right. Just gives him a little bit of a kind of buffer to before he starts getting attacked. I mean, I got to think this campaign to defend America is going to start coming at him pretty hard pretty soon. So,
well, we saw the AFL-CIO this week announcing a multi-million-dollar campaign to really try and define him and to fill the void that obviously Obama and Clinton can't right now. So I think that's going to be something to watch for as well, especially in those industrial Midwest states. You know, they recognize the fact that they can't lose places like Michigan and Pennsylvania and keep the White House. So they're going to try and define McCain on the economy. And look, if the dominant issue in this race is the economy and the war continues to be relegated to the back pages, that could be a problem for McCain.
Right. In a way, a victim of his success on the war then, in a way, or at least his success in convincing people it's going okay?
Yeah, he wants to make this about national security and about the sort of, you know, challenge of our time from Islamic terrorism. If that threat is seen to be lessened or sort of mitigated somehow by virtue in part of our efforts here, like you said, then I think it's probably tougher for him to win just because Obama or Clinton can just simply say, are you better off now than you were 8 years ago, and can focus on the pocketbook issues.
All right, well, good talking to you, Jonathan. Did we miss anything?
I don't think so, but this is a fun race for us to cover, and we are very, very lucky to have this Democratic race going forward here.
It's God's gift to Politico.com.
More viewers and more listeners. Our editors love it. Thanks, Ben. See you, man.
Thank you. See you.